Thanks for tuning in. Host Noah Weil is a licensed attorney admitted to practice in Washington State and the Federal Court of the Western District of Washington. Some guests on this program may be licensed attorneys as well. However, the discussion on this podcast is intended to be informative only and is not a substitute for legal advice for your particular situation. The information may be right or may be wrong. Changing laws and the laws of individual states mean the information presented here may not be accurate. But regardless, and this part is important, neither Noah nor any guest here is your lawyer. If you need a lawyer for your individual situation, you should consult and retain your own attorney.
This is Noah Weil with the Better Know a Lawyer podcast, and today I'm joined by Seattle Police Department Officer Eric Mitchell. Eric, thanks for coming.
Hi, thanks for having me, Noah.
I really appreciate you coming out.
Sure.
I know it was a big deal. You had to talk to your chain of command. You had to talk to the media relations department in Seattle Police.
Yes.
Did they have any problems with it?
Not at all.
Okay. I know there's some ground rules in the beginning. I'm not going to ask you to name any names specifically. I'm not going to denigrate the Seattle Police Department specifically, and you're not going to later shoot me and then plant a gun on my lifeless body.
I agree.
Okay, that's great. And we're all understand the rules.
All right.
So, Officer Mitchell, why don't we start off by telling us how long you've been an officer and, you know, what you've done.
Well, I've joined the police department in September of 1980, just 2.5 months after I graduated from high school as a dispatcher and a 911 operator. But I always wanted to be a Seattle police officer since I was 14. So when I turned 22, I passed all the tests. I went to the academy and was commissioned as a Seattle police officer in June of 1984. And then I've served in operations for almost all of my career, except for like a 2-month stint I did as a temporary detective in the North Precinct when I was on light duty for an injury. But all of my time as a police officer has been spent either in patrol or in the traffic section, like where I'm at right now in the DUI squad.
So over 35 years as an officer?
Well, 31 as an officer, 35 years total service with the department.
Okay. Has the department changed in your time there?
Oh, yeah.
Give us some examples of how it was in the beginning.
Well, the technology certainly has changed. When I hopped in my first police car, had revolving overhead lights, a red one on one side, a blue one on the other one, and it rotated, and had a siren bell in the middle of the bar. It had a two-way radio, and no AM/FM radio, no air conditioning, and no electric windows, and no partition between the front and back seats. So if you made an arrest, another officer to join up with you, and then one officer ride in the back seat next to the guy you arrested, and you drive him off to jail. Now we have, of course, video cameras and recorders. All the cars have partitions in them. We have computers with internet capability, and was commonly referred to as a mobile data computer. The lighting schemes are all different. The equipment is all different. And in my assignment, I got a take-home car because I'm on call almost all the time. And so I got to take my own police car home. I never thought I'd ever get to have my own police car with all this technology in it.
Is it the full lit-up car and everything? It's obviously a police car?
Yes, it is. The neighbors love it.
I'm sure they do. Just parked in your driveway?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's great.
And then, of course, the rules of the department have changed quite a bit. Of course, we have the Department of Justice in town now that's gone through the department. And a lot of the rules and how we enforce the law has changed drastically from what it was when I first started, which was even before we had the Domestic Violence Protection Act, which came into being in September of 1984.
I definitely want to talk to you about some of those changes and about enforcing the law, but I'm curious, why did you want to be a police officer so early?
I was 14 years old and one of those kids that was on the top of the fence. I could have gone either way. Delivered newspapers in North Seattle where I grew up, and the neighborhood police officers that patrolled the area kind of took me under their wing and impressed me with their work. I actually got to see them in action a couple of times. They let me ride around in the police car with them. And it was their example that I wanted to follow. I wanted to be like them. And that's why I became a Seattle police officer.
You've been described by other defense attorneys as a very honorable, very upfront police officer. The reputation in the offices I've worked has been, if you have an Eric Mitchell case, you know he says what happens. He didn't exaggerate. He didn't embellish. Do you feel you exemplify those qualities?
I think I do, yes. You know, I live in the city. I own property in the city and grew up here, went to school here. I have a lot invested in the city of Seattle, and I believe tremendously in the role of the Seattle Police Department and what it plays in the city today. And I think that's the only way you can be with people, so that if you're standing in the grocery store line with them someday, they're going to look at you and respect you.
Now, not to talk about Seattle Police specifically, but I think we both know officers in places in the country don't always have those qualities.
Yes.
And do you think it's just living in the city that you're patrolling, or are there other factors too?
Well, living in the city is part of it, of course, because I have a vested interest in the people that live here. But I think that when you look at the big picture here of what a police officer represents, I think it's incredibly important for us to be on top of our game as much as we possibly can. Of course, we're only human and we all do make errors from time to time, but I think that it's important maybe for people not to respect us so much as individuals, but respect us for the institution that we represent, and that is to preserve the peace and quiet and the security of the city, which is important, I think, to everybody.
I totally agree with you, but it's a challenge, right? When we hear of these stories from the bad apples in the groups, the ones that lie in the reports or take things personally, commit crimes while wearing a badge, how do we separate the goals, the aspirations of a police department from its worst members?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there's no easy answer to that because that's not the way I've ever operated myself, out doing those things that people don't like. I guess we start by selecting people that have a vested interest in the community that they live in. A good example of that is there was a time in Seattle where in order to be a Seattle police officer, you had to live in the city.
And I think now it's 20% of the police officers live in the city?
The last survey we did is 18%.
Okay.
Of the officers live in the city of Seattle. And I know that I think all of the, well, I'm pretty certain all the command staff today lives in the city. But I think to begin with, I think you have the vested interest here. And being a resident is, in fact, a vested interest. You work in the area that you live in, and so you have a legitimate concern and you want to make sure things go well. And that's a big motivator for me. But a lot of officers obviously don't choose not to live in the city.
Priced out. Because
priced out,
the city
yeah.
is very expensive right now.
Yes, it is. We were talking about that just the other night. You know, when you look back at history of law enforcement, the people that kept order actually were part of the community, and they were paid a certain amount of money to do that, to keep order in the community that they lived in. And we've kind of gotten away with that from that over time, and now you don't have to live in the city to be a police officer here.
Is that it, though? Is it just you're not a part of the community you're policing, so you don't feel that connection?
I think that's a big part of it. Here's the other angle of it as well. What got me interested in this line of work was the officers that I watched in action. And I'm actually friends with these men today, still. Mm-hmm. I've gone fishing and hunting with them. I've gone motorcycle riding with them recently. These are people that I know that are my friends. But back in that day, a patrol officer had a lot more time just to interact with the community. And under the best case scenario, between 40 and 60% of your time as a patrol officer spent just being seen and your presence being known in the area that you're working in. And that's in and by itself is a great deterrent to crime because criminals are going to see you out there. A police officer walking down the street, or a couple of officers walking down the street, or a patrol car cruising by, talking to people, getting to know people. You make those connections. And then there's a feeling of pride in your area, concern about the area that you're patrolling, and you don't want to do wrong. I think we've gotten away from that, maybe not intentionally, but we did because the dynamics of the job have changed so much. We don't have the time to do the interaction that we used to.
You had mentioned earlier that these two officers that took you under their wing showed you around, did ride-alongs. I did a ride-along 5 or 6 years ago, and it was fun, and I enjoyed it. We can talk about that if you want. But I know I had to sign a waiver, and I don't think they would have let me do it if I was 14 years old, maybe. But I was in my 30s. Is there still the opportunity for someone like you or a younger version of you to be kind of apprenticed or learn the ropes from an officer in person, a teen?
I think the opportunity exists to build personal relationships with some officers. I think the biggest challenge that we have today is the time factor. You know, even when I was a patrol officer 14 years ago now, since I was a patrol, you know, I worked in my district, I worked quite a bit with a group of kids that lived in a trailer park, and ultimately one of those kids became my daughter. I adopted her. And those are the good times. When I look at what I did back then with those families, I don't think today I would have the time to do it because we're just so busy. As far as a 14-year-old riding a police car today as an observer, it's against department policy. You have to be at least 16, and your parents have to approve it now. And that's just within the last 10, 11 years that changed. So it'd be a lot harder to put a 14-year-old in a police car so they could ride around and watch what the police officer does. And it's also a lot more dangerous today than it was back then as well.
Why do you say that?
I think the amount of violent crime has increased. The exposure to danger has increased considerably. So I would be concerned about my 14-year-old riding a Seattle police car today, just given what's been going on lately. You just don't know.
Do you think the streets have become more dangerous in the last 20 years?
Oh, absolutely. Certainly have.
And do you think that's because, well, for one factor, the police aren't doing as much? They're at their desk doing paperwork or whatever? Or are there other factors involved in that too? It's a complicated question. Why is crime up?
I think part of the reason is that we can't, given the way we have to work today, we can't provide that preventive patrol, that incentive not to commit crime, or that threshold not to cross at the level that we were able to back when I was 14 years old. And I'll give you a couple of examples. When you look at a job that I do, drunk drivers, that's a 3.5-hour job today if everything goes right. And I work a 9-hour shift. So you're talking about almost half of a watch out handling a DUI arrest. You put that on a patrol officer, a DUI arrest on a patrol officer, and that's half of his watch away from his district. So that district goes unstaffed. You know, 25, 30 years ago when I first started doing DUIs on my own, I could pound one of those out an hour and a half, 2 hours, usually. But now it's increased tremendously. And that's just because of the nature of the law and the quality of the investigation that has to be conducted in order to get it into court. Another one is the Domestic Violence Protection Act. There was a time that I could respond to a call and settle it with no report. It was just a log entry if there was a family squabble of some type. Today, in a lot of cases, if a crime has been committed, a crime of violence, an assault, we're required to make an arrest. And it doesn't stop us making the arrest, and you've got to document everything. You got to take photographs. You got to arrange for the victim's safety. You have to take a statement from the suspect. If the suspect has injured himself or herself, they've got to go to the hospital, and they've got to be guarded. That easily eats up a couple of hours of time off your preventive patrol opportunities. And so when you take us off the road like that, then there's just fewer police officers out stirring around, just being seen. Yet staffing levels in the department haven't increased. at least from what I've seen, to keep up with that workload. And so now this is the price we pay, is we don't have as much exposure, people seeing us moving around and being seen in the public.
Sometimes I hear from people who think there's a cultural shift, that we as a society are more prone to crime. You know, there's maybe less religion in the schools, or the people who we elect are tacitly condoning crime. Do you feel that way too, or do you, is it...
I think, I was thinking about this last night, and I was actually prepared for this question, and it reminds me of a story. And and I live close to the old Interurban Trail, and I actually walked it last night with my dog. And the Interurban was a train, an electric train that ran from downtown Seattle to Everett and back. And there's a story, when they were talking about the Interurban Train, there's a woman who lived up by Bitter Lake that... when she's talking about the old Interurban, she remembers at 11 years old earning enough money to go downtown and buy a doll that she wanted. So she hopped on the Interurban at 11 years old and rode downtown Seattle by herself and bought this doll that she really wanted. And she came home all by herself on the Interurban electric train back to her home in Bitter Lake. And she talks about how the sun was setting and the weather and everything. It was just a real touching story to listen to that. So you look at the way things are today, would you want your 11-year-old daughter riding the number E bus down Aurora, downtown Seattle at 11 years old, to buy a doll downtown and come back? So, I mean, realistically, when you look at what goes on down there, so how did we get from the Interurban story to 2015? What happened? Well, our standards, I think, have kind of collapsed for one reason or another. Gunplay. Is a significant part of it. People that don't fear consequences, they just don't care about other people. I think it's a combination of everything that you mentioned that kind of goes into all of this. And
now some people say, and I'm sorry to cut you off, some people say, and I agree to this to some extent, that it's not so much that the instances of crime have gone up, and we can have statistics to look at that. Some crimes have, some crimes haven't. But that the reporting has just become overwhelming, that incidents that would just not make the news suddenly are, with our social media and our 24-hour news cycle, more visible for people. So there's this illusion of seeing more crime when, in fact, it's just more reported crime.
I suppose that could be part of it. I guess my concern was mostly is things that involve our safety and our security, which, of course, could be things like car prowling and whatnot. But, you know, of course, we've had a population boom as well.
Sure.
A lot more people, and you bring a lot more people, you bring a lot more, the problems come with a lot more people. Has the police department kept up with the, as far as its staffing, kept up with the Joneses as far as keeping that patrol level and the threshold that people don't want to cross into the criminal behavior? Have we succeeded in keeping that threshold alive? And I don't think we have because of our staffing. I think if we had more of a uniform presence to give people a second thought, maybe I won't do that. Maybe I won't break into that car. Maybe I won't snatch that woman's purse, or maybe I won't shoot that guy because the police are right there. If that might make a difference, I wonder.
It can't hurt.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, it's not that we want, you know,
I think
cameras in every corner and that kind of thing.
But. Right. Well, that's going to be for detection, you know, but I think you and I would both agree that damage control is less preferred than prevention. I mean, we would rather see people kept out of prison and not break the law than wait till after the damage is done and then send them off to the prison system. And I don't see a whole lot of people coming out of there better than they did when they went in.
We're going to talk about that also.
Sure.
No, I agree. If there's a way to reduce crime, I mean, except for obviously my business depends on crime happening, so not
so
zero, yeah, not zero, but you know, lower in some areas. but I want to go back to your statement about the community,
sure,
about patrolling the community. Some officers I've talked to, you know, in kind of impersonal or not impersonal, informal ways like this versus more professional settings, there seems to be kind of a divide. Some believe like you do that it's a community job, that you're members of the community, you're there to serve the public, that kind of thing. And some more kind of pay lip service to that and are very, I wouldn't say confrontational, but it's a very us versus them kind of thing. we're in danger all the time. There's enemies around every corner. We've got to get the bad guys, you know, they're lurking and we're that kind of thing. Do you feel that's a fair assessment of police officers, or do you feel that it's more nuanced than that? And if it's the first one, is that a fair or correct way to look at the world?
First of all, I would agree that that is a fair characterization of some police officers. I think that's been a concern of mine for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think is it fair not for us to see the world that way? No, not necessarily, but I understand it. And the reason I understand it is I think that we've been so focused for so long on going from call to call to call to call and enforcing the law and enforcing the law, enforcing the law. You don't get the good stuff that goes with that 40 to 60%. And I got a lot of personal experiences, and that I was part of that 40 to 60% for those three. These are two officers, actually three officers that took me under their wing when I was 14. And I had this discussion with one of them at the retired officers banquet last month. We were talking about how long we've known each other, and he told me how much it meant to him to be able to impact my life the way that he did, and how beneficial that was for him as well. We don't have these officers that you've encountered, that you just talked about, that have this us versus them attitude. I understand that. But the ones, and you've encountered them, so have I.
Yeah.
Okay. They haven't had that opportunity. They haven't been given that chance to interact with people the way that I got to interact with the police when I was younger, and that I was able to interact with people in my patrol district when I was a patrol officer. They didn't have that opportunity, and so they don't get the benefit of that feeling, of that interaction, and that's something I sadly is missing from many police officers today, is that they don't have that sense of friendship or companionship or cooperative relationship with the people that they are actually protecting.
You mentioned earlier that one of the things to increase the level of positive police officers in the force is at the entry level, making sure you get the right people in and not the right wrong people. Do you see, I don't know how much you work with cadets or anything like that, but do you see some people that are like, this person is just a bad fit for policing, they will never be a positive influence in the community, they'll always be very confrontational, oppositional, versus people who are idealistic and kind of get ground down through the routine?
I've seen both, and some of them actually come around. Other ones don't. Some of them hopefully at some point realize it's not the job for them and move on to something else. I've seen some that continue and they get themselves in trouble, and I've seen some that have been so soft they get themselves hurt. It's a delicate balance because you're going to have to confront hostility at some point in your career. So you have to have the right balance, and you get that not only through training but just sheer experience and being out there and learning how to interact with people.
The problem is the officers that shouldn't be police officers and should never be police officers can do a lot of damage to themselves and the community before that becomes apparent.
Yep.
Is there anything that police departments can do to kind of weed those bad apples out beforehand?
I think that today they're doing as much as they can, but I think that, you know, back in the old days, probably 40 some odd years ago, that were called police cadets in the department, and they were 18 years old, paid employees, and they were hired they were serving what's called an apprenticeship to become police officer. And they worked in the department in records, they worked in communications, they worked in all the detective units, and learned how the department flowed, how things worked in the department. They shadowed working police officers in non-enforcement activities, and the department had an opportunity then to look at those individuals to see if they were a good fit, if they had the dedication and had the investment to make in the department, and then they had an option to look at, or the opportunity to look at the profession themselves, if I fit in here. We lost that in the early 70s, long before my time. And they did away with that program. They hired people directly into the position of police recruit, and then they became police officers. They didn't have a whole lot of opportunity to experience the profession and the department. So the department could weed those out that probably didn't belong here. Today, we hire directly from other professions, and they go right into basic training. Some do come in through other, like I did, as a dispatcher. So the department had an opportunity to look at me for 3.5 years before they hired me as a recruit, and then commissioned me as a police officer. Some come in as PEOs. Some come in as dispatchers, not as many anymore. So I think that maybe the department needs more time to evaluate somebody in a non-enforcement capacity to see how they fit in with the department and its mission before they actually make them police officers.
That's not happening right now?
It's not happening now. What happens now is once you go through the background investigation, the polygraph, psychological evaluation, oral board, medical examination, all of that, and you are hired as a police recruit, your first stop is the police academy for 6 months or 5 months. It's 770 hours. And it's the same training that all municipal and county police officers throughout the state have to successfully pass. And it's pretty intensive. They've shifted their model less from like a military basic training facility. Now they've toned it down a little bit. There's still some of the military operations that go on there, but they shifted the theme from warrior to community caretaker or guardian. That's under their new director. And then from there, they return to the Seattle Police Department in what's called post-bleat training, which I think lasts a month and a half, and then they go out into the field. So they really don't get to see the Seattle Police Department after they get hired until they've actually been to the post-bleat or have been through the basic law enforcement training, which is called bleat, and then they're commissioned as police officers, and then they go through field training, and then they're out on the street under supervision for a year until they're actually permanent members of the department. But they're carrying guns, and they have the authority to arrest people, and they can do what I do, all on their very own. But they have no civil service protection in that first year. They can be dismissed without cause, but without the opportunity to challenge that through the Civil Service Commission. That's the only opportunity the department gets. But by the time it gets to that point, they've invested a lot in that individual. They've paid for their training. That's a good amount of money for 770 hours of training. Their field training, the post-bleat, the background investigation, the polygraph, all that stuff costs the city money. And to have somebody flunk out after all of that, that's a pretty devastating loss to the city. So I think maybe if we did something to bring people into the department earlier, before they got to that point to see if they're a good fit, that might help.
Do you think departments will bend over backwards to try to keep them in and make good on their investment?
To a reasonable extent, yes. I think if a person can be, and I've trained new officers, and if I think if an officer can be trained up to the point that they are an asset to the city, then I think it's worthwhile. It's a pretty big investment. But if they show a problem with either their character or their ability to do the job properly, and it's going to be long term, and they can't be trained. Then, of course, the department's going to have to do something because of the liability that they face, plus the damage you can do to the department.
And the community.
And the community, certainly. Which is why, and I say the department, because I include the community in the department.
Sure. But that is an interesting distinction because we've had some stories lately, and again, some in Seattle, some other workplaces,
sure,
where an officer has done something that has brought disrepute on their force. Should there be erring on the side of heavier sanctions for an officer just to preserve that appearance of respect and decorum among police officers? Or should they be given more of a break because they're on the street and the people who are looking back, obviously, are behind their desks or in a courtroom or something, don't have that same split-second decision the officer has to make?
I think it depends on what happened. Of course, the big hot topic today is use of force. And if it comes to things like lying, cheating, stealing, for things that you're doing in the line of duty, we can't tolerate that. When you look at how much we're given as far as when you testify under oath, I think that it's hard to argue against that kind of thing. When it comes to things like use of force, which is part of the job, I get, and of course we have no video here, but I get a distance between my two fingers here about 1 inch worth of time to make a decision that everybody else gets, you know, a yardstick long to second guess. And so in cases like that where I make a decision, a use of force decision in good faith, thinking I'm doing the right thing and it's within reason, then I think you got to fall on the side of the officer. We don't have the opportunity to make or analyze our decisions like the outsiders do, the people that reviewers do, or the general public does later when they're looking at a shooting or when someone resists arrest, we fight them and that sort of thing. We have to make a decision right now. There's no one size fits all. We have to act now. And the reason is if we don't, then a couple things can happen. If we fail to use enough force, we end up getting ourselves hurt. We can't defend our firearms. Firearms get taken away from you by a combative suspect. They have access to your police car. I mean, it's endless, the trouble they can cause if somebody gets away or overpowers you. On the other hand, if you go over the top on somebody and you injure them to the point where you shouldn't have, and then you're making everybody look bad, and you're doing the wrong thing. You've injured somebody without a good reason. So for us, that's another one of those delicate balances. I think that when it comes to use of force for things that when you do something you thought was the right thing at the time, it's within reason, you had a reason for it, I think you have to fall on the side of the police officer. When it comes to things like integrity, I think that's an absolute. We have to. Those are the people that we have. We can't have working here because it hurts all of us, and it destroys the mission of the ultimate mission of the department.
I want to touch on the use of force in a little bit,
sure.
But just as another category, there's been some stories about officers who have said racial things,
yes,
which are not illegal. They're not perjuring themselves, but it still doesn't look good.
No.
Where are you on discipline on that? Do you feel like there's a First Amendment issue? They can say what they want.
No.
Versus maintaining the reputation.
I don't agree that there's a First Amendment protection for us to say whatever we want when we're on the job. I don't think we're allowed to do that. We can't. You can't. And the rules have been in place for a long, long, long time that you can't insult people because, well, we're supposed to insult people at all anyways, but you can't insult people because of their political affiliation, their religious affiliation, their ethnicity, or their sexual orientation. Flat can't do it. It's a loser. And it's been known to us for a long time. And for that to happen today, after all of us know this, and it's been, you know, drilled into our heads for such a long time, for it to happen today is a big disappointment because it hurts. It hurts us. It hurts the community. It hurts the police department. It doesn't make things easy for any of us who want to go out and continue to do the work.
Let me give you a hypothetical.
Sure.
An officer, not Seattle, just a random city, is found out to be a KKK member. There's never been a blemish on his record, never anything on video, anything like that. But the police department still wants to dismiss him because they just feel having a KKK member on the force makes them look bad, and they can't separate his personal views on race from his work. Would you support that?
Yes, absolutely. We're talking about we have constitutional rights as police officers, but they're different when it comes to like the First Amendment. We can't just go out and belong to groups like that. The hate group. It's a hate group is what it is. We can't effectively serve the community and belong to a hate group.
Well, I agree with you. but you know, some officers don't agree. They feel what we do on our private time is our business, and when we're on the clock, that's what we do.
I think to an extent, what we do on our private lives is our business. But I think it goes when it comes to things like hate groups. We go beyond that. And remember, you're a police officer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You carry that office with you no matter where you go. on or off duty.
Okay.
And I think that's that I'll draw the line. You can't be a member of a KKK group and then be a police officer anywhere in this nation, I feel.
Well, again, I agree. And I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah.
So let's go back to use of force. I'm going to talk about stops in a little bit. But when I was doing that ride-along, the officer would touch the car of the car he'd stopped. And he told me why. I asked him. I noticed every time. He said, I'm leaving my fingerprints on the car so that in case I get shot by this officer, shot by the suspect, they'll be able to track him down and know that this was the car. And I was like, wow, that's just an incredible thing to consider. And it's just part of his routine. How much is your adrenaline running when you're doing someone pulling somebody over?
Depends on the nature of the stop. I'll probably stop. I guess last night I stopped 4 cars. It was a quiet night, but sometimes as many as 15 or 20.
You're going to take care of that ticket for me, right? Like, that's just going to be
sure.
Yeah,
no
thanks,
problem.
Yeah, that was awkward.
Visa or MasterCard. when you first get started in this line of work, that first traffic stop, I'll never forget my first traffic stop. You walk out, you're really nervous, but you get a routine down after a while. I think I'm very much into training and as far as how you're going to react when something goes down on you. So I have a routine of my own all set up when I walk up to the car. And what I'm looking at, I zone in on the inside of the car, and I'm looking for movement. Whereas I stand back from the what's called the B-pillar, so look to the driver's side of the car, a little bit back, so the guy has to make an effort to turn and look at me. So your adrenaline is going, but you can't let it debilitate you. You can't let it stop you from going up there and doing the work. Now, if you got a car full of people that look like they're going to be trouble or shuffling around in there, or if the guy looks high on something, you don't want to have some backups there, whenever possible. And then you get a different vantage point as far as looking inside and that type of stuff. But you're thinking tactically, what do I do if this guy opens fires on me? What am I going to do?
And that's kind of where I'm going with this. The split-second decisions, it seems like if you come at them with this, I'm vulnerable here, I need to protect myself, mm-hmm. Do you think that leads to more instances of force? Maybe unjustified force, maybe justified.
Boy, I don't know. All I can do is tell you the way I walk up on somebody is I don't think that they're able to see me really. Because I have on a nighttime basis, I've got the car flooded with lights, so they can't really see my approach. They probably aren't even in a position to see what I'm doing. And unless we're looking at their tiny rearview mirror, and they can look at it. It's hard to say because I don't have that many conflicts when I stop cars. I watch my back. I watch what's going on inside the car, and I make it so that it's hard for somebody to actually do something to me up there. And they have to actually try to make a big effort to turn on me and do something. And a lot of it's the way I address the people, too. I try to keep them talking and thinking about what's going on between them and I, as opposed to what they're going to grab in the car to come at me with. The only thing that makes that a challenge is if you got a car full of people and you got somebody with if you're right next to their window and they roll the passenger's window and they roll it down, they want to start chipping away. Then makes you a little more nervous, you know.
Do you have the driver come out or do you just wait for other backup cars?
Usually, I'll read the situation. Like if it's a car full of people and they're being pretty reasonable, yeah, after you've done this for so long, you can pretty much you can read people. If I think there's going to be some hostility, I'll call for another officer to show up and keep everybody in the car busy until I'm done doing what I've got to do with somebody out on the sidewalk. If it's a DUI stop, if it's just going to be a simple traffic infraction, well, I'll just tell people I'll have you on your way in just a minute. I'll be right back and make them think it's going to be a quick interaction, they'll be on their way, and there really won't be any reason to be hostile towards me. There's always a chance, I suppose, that something can turn wrong and go bad on me. And you can't eliminate all those risks. You just have to be prepared to respond to them when they happen.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Thank you for explaining it. I kind of want to talk about the patrol work and just those traffic stops. Mm-hmm. The first question before we get into the timeline is, what do you think, from my listeners' point of view, who some or none are police officers, is the biggest misconception about police on patrol?
Wow. You know, that's such a wide a wide concept. I think that it depends on where you're coming from. That we're just picking on people. Well, no, I mean, we don't stop people for no reason. That's probably the first thing people don't want. They don't like being interfered with, and they don't like they're having us taking time out of their day to enforce the law. Like for instance, for what I do, I stop traffic violators for a reason. It's because these people are contributing to traffic collisions. Whether they're speeding or their car's not in good order. Those are the two big ones. Or they're making illegal turns, running red lights, that type of stuff. Well, that's all dangerous things. If your car is not properly equipped. The reason I'm taking time out of your day and probably money out of your pocket when I hand you a green traffic ticket is because what you're doing is dangerous. And not because I'm trying to win a trip to Mazatlan by writing the most traffic tickets. It's because what you're doing is I'm calling your attention to something that's dangerous, giving you an incentive to fix the problem or correct your driving behavior. What happens between you and the court is what happens between you and the court. But right now what I'm doing is I'm enforcing the law and calling your attention to this problem. From a patrol officer standpoint, if they're doing something called a Terry stop, that's short probable cause, more than just a mere suspicion, but it's a suspicion where you can't make a full custody arrest, but you can stop and talk to somebody. The reason for that is, first of all, to investigate an ambiguous situation where you think this person might be involved in criminal activity and prevent it from happening. Second thing is to create, again, a threshold or some knowledge in a person's mind. The police are out working. So if you are intending to commit a crime somewhere, you'll think twice and not commit that crime and go about your business. So when the police stop and talk to you, that's what we're trying to accomplish, is we're trying to accomplish that goal. We're trying to prevent crime if it's short of a probable cause arrest.
Okay. We're definitely going to get back to that portion.
Sure.
But let's just start from the beginning of an average day.
Sure.
You roll up to your station, uniform.
Mm-hmm.
You check in. Do you get the assignments from roll call?
Right. And where I work in traffic, it's a little different than that because we already know what we're going to be doing. We're going to be out looking for drunk drivers and impaired drivers, people impaired by drugs. But in a patrol officer's life, they show up for work, change clothes, usually in the locker room, they have a roll call. Sergeant holds roll call, discusses any information that needs to be brought to their attention, crime trends, or somebody who's wanted, administrative details, that type of stuff. And then you go down to your car, you check your car out, make sure everything works, and then you're out on the road. And then the dispatcher knows that you're in service and they can start throwing calls at you. Or you can just go out driving around if you have time for that. So you might be patrolling an area and then encounter a situation that you think needs to be addressed. It could be a suspicious person walking down the street, checking car doors, somebody lurking around the back of someone's house that doesn't want to be seen, maybe somebody smoking something out of a glass pipe. All of that stuff is suspicious to a patrol officer, and then they have to act on it.
What are the things, either from drivers or from people on the street? You said one, which was looking into car windows, and you said some others, which was making a wrong left turn or running a red light.
Sure.
What are the kinds of things that draw the attention of police officers on patrol?
Well, I was told to me once that, and maybe people buy this, maybe they don't, but police officers have a sixth sense, and we kind of know when something is out of place. And you get that just your experience. And an officer might see somebody that in an area where a high crime area that appears to be concealing something from them, doesn't want to be seen. Maybe they've gotten a call of a car prowl two blocks away, and this guy's got a big bulge underneath his jacket. They might get a call of somebody complaining about a hooker on Aurora. And they see this girl walking down Aurora. She might be making eye contact and maybe gesturing towards passing cars repeatedly. These people are walking up and talking to her. She's talking through the open direct passenger window. All of this stuff could have innocent explanations, of course. But a patrol officer's mind, who has training and experience, looks at that and says, well, that might be criminal activity also. So that's where we get into the Terry stop, mm-hmm. where you stop somebody based on reasonable suspicion that you, that the officer has in their mind to stop and clear up an ambiguous situation. So those are the kinds of things we're looking for.
You have these articulable facts.
Articulable, as, exactly.
As we would say in the business.
But it's so delicate because remember that you know, you can't just walk up and arrest somebody for stuff like that. Well, I can't, you have to have more than just a suspicion for probable cause. You have, it's a whole different definition. But a reasonable suspicion that someone is about to be involved in criminal activity or is involved in criminal activity, and that stopping to clear it, to clear up that that suspicion, those circumstances, is part of a police officer's job.
I have a friend, he's a black friend. He posted this on Facebook today, so that wasn't part of my script, but here we are.
All right.
I won't tell you what city he's in, but it rhymes with Meattle. He was stopped by a police officer. Mm-hmm. It might have been the sheriff's, it might have been Washington State Patrol, I don't know. But he was stopped, and the reason was he was allegedly weaving in his lane.
Okay.
He was not given a ticket, but as part of the exchange with the law enforcement person, they asked my friend if he had any guns in his car.
Okay.
How do you feel about a question like that where it's not like the trunk is riding low, like it looks like there's weapons in there or there's gang signs or anything on there? The question like just basically out of nowhere, arguably because of his race, but who knows? Maybe there's been gun trafficking in the area. But do you feel like that's legitimate within a Terry stop?
You know, it would depend on what the officer knew at the time and what was going through his head. You know, I just don't walk up, hey, do you have any guns in your car? I don't usually ask that question on stops. We can ask all the questions that we want. It's what we do physically as far as invading people's privacy, like going through their car or searching them, that it becomes an issue. But if I ask somebody, oh, do you have any guns in your car? Well, then what if I said yes? Yeah, I've got guns in my car. Does that mean you get to go in there and take them? You know, I stop people all the time that are armed and they got concealed weapons permits, and I don't disarm them because I figure the way I think about it, is that if the guy wanted to do something to me with the gun on video camera, he'd just do it. I mean, he wouldn't tell me,
yeah.
Right? He would just do it and then drive away. But now that I've asked him, I know you got a gun on you. Okay, you got a permit? Yeah, all right. Okay, I'll be back to see you with the ticket in a minute. Or a warning notice, whatever I decide to do. It would depend on what's going through the officer's head when he asks the question. And he'd have to justify that. Let's say if your guy wanted to make a complaint. So, you know, he asked this question, and I'd like an explanation as to why he asked the question. The officer has to explain that to superiors. Why did you ask the question?
Is that a reasonable concern for my friend that, or anybody really, that, you know, yes, I made a wrong left turn, you know, mm-hmm. There was a red arrow. But now I'm just being asked about where I'm going, where I'm coming from, if I've got weapons, if I've got drugs in my car. Is it some point where it seems like phishing or it does seem more targeted?
Well, it seems like it's phishing to me if the questions are asked, but then again, I don't know what the officer knows.
Right. In this case, it's a hypothetical. Like
right.
I said,
sure, of course. But let's say it's phishing, and let's say the officer works in an area where there's a lot of gun play going on. There's a lot of drug trafficking going on, and maybe this guy does match the description of somebody who's been involved in that kind of stuff, or. And so then you make the inquiries. That's the only way to learn stuff, I suppose.
It seems to me that you could ask those questions if there is a purpose behind them, but it would
sure.
be nice to tell the driver, hey, here's why I asked you. In this area has been seeing a lot of gun issues, and I just wanted to make sure. Thank you for answering my questions. Have a nice day.
That's right. And that would probably head off a complaint at some point.
But I don't see that from his story. I didn't ask him
right.
detail. But, you know, I think... To me, it seems like it's getting it back to that community thing where if you want to have those invasive things, and, you know, stopping somebody is invasive.
Sure.
Just going about their business. And it's totally lawful. That's
yes.
fine. But ending on the note about here's why this happened, here's what my thinking was, seems like a nice way to just get back to that square one. Thank you for understanding. Now we both know something more.
That's actually in a film that we watched in training, that exact scenario played out where, well, the officer was looking for witnesses, and the It was a white officer and a black witness, and the hostility between them was pretty obvious. And then the officer finally explained himself, look, I'm trying to do the right thing here and keep someone from getting hurt. I'm hoping that you have some information that I can use to reach that goal. If you can help me stop this from happening. And then the witness actually saw the light and realized, you know, I understand why this question was asked of me, and yeah, I'll get a hold of you and find something out. And I think that reasonable people will understand that if you explain yourself, you're given the opportunity to. I can think lately of a couple of instances where I wasn't given that opportunity. People walked in and complained, and I wasn't given the opportunity to explain why I asked questions for traffic-related stuff. But I wasn't given the opportunity. But I think once people hear the explanations to why we think what we think or why we do what we do, then it creates a lot more understanding.
Is that part of the training to discuss why these events happened?
Whenever we could pull it off operationally, yes. Whenever it's feasible, whenever we have the time to, the opportunity to, then yes. It's because it'll get done one way or the other. Somebody makes a complaint, you're going to have to explain it either then or later.
Okay, so let's talk about complaints.
Sure.
I'm sure there's some people who think, I'm gonna go to the police station, write out a complaint, and the desk person is going to take it and put it nicely in the trash can, and that'll be the end of it. What actually happens?
All complaints go to the Office of Professional Accountability Day, everything. And they're screened up out up there. And what happens is the complaints of serious misconduct are taken in for investigation. The ones that are minor in nature go back to the officer's supervision, and they conduct either a line investigation or they contact the complainant and they try to settle it at the next level down. I don't know what their criteria is for classifying what is serious and what isn't. I know it's pretty involved. It's been pretty busy up there today. It's a whole new structure now. But as far as things getting just thrown away, that doesn't happen, especially today.
So if somebody does make a complaint against a police officer, it will be investigated?
It'll be investigated somehow, some way, yeah.
Okay. For the driver or pedestrian that's being contacted by the police, what is their best practices?
Best practices to not be hostile and follow our instructions. And again, we don't always have the opportunity to explain why we're doing things before we do them. In other words, if I stop somebody who I think has been involved in a shooting and it appears to me that they're armed, I'm not going to explain all that before I pat somebody down for weapons. I'm just going to stop them and do it. And then I'll check them for weapons. If I think somebody has committed a criminal by a probable cause to arrest, and I decide to say, you are under arrest, put you in handcuffs and search you, I'm not going to have the opportunity to explain everything to you before I get to that point. In other words, once I make the call, that's where we're at, whether I'm going to be making a Terry stop, patting you down for weapons, or if I'm placing you under arrest and searching you to full custody, custodial search incident to arrest and putting you in a police car, that's where we are. If you don't want to talk with us, that's fine. It's your right not to talk with us if you don't want to. But if we tell you to stop or we say you're under arrest, don't run and don't resist arrest. If we're wrong, then you make a complaint. And if you want to make a claim with the city and say that you were damaged somehow, do that. If the city denies your claim or if your complaint is unfounded, you have to live with that. You can file a lawsuit if you want. But if we tell you to stop in a Terry stop and you don't stop and you run away, or if you make a movement towards your pockets where we think you're carrying a gun or a knife or something, we're going to have to do something to stop that. And if you don't obey our orders in those circumstances, it's either resisting arrest or obstructing. We can use force to overcome that resistance if necessary. And then be heard, it'll all be explained in court later. And if we're wrong, then you'll probably be entitled to some compensation for that if we're wrong. But we don't get to hold court out in the field. There's no time for that. just cooperate. Just cooperate. Go with a program. Do what the officer tells you to do. If you were wrong, then make a complaint about it later and file a claim about it later. But don't resist arrest and don't run from us because we're going to respond to that.
Now, I heard there's a code phrase. You can tell an officer that they're arresting you, and you can tell them the secret phrase, and they'll say, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir," and then they'll let you go and just be on your way. Is that true?
A code phrase?
Yeah, some kind of magic statement that just is like, "Oh, I must have made. I didn't know you knew the phrase."
Oh.
Hey, everyone. This is Noah. The podcast was going really long. We really enjoy talking with each other, so I decided to break it up into two parts. Come back next week for the end of my interview with Officer Eric Mitchell. We talk about staying silent and other useful tips and tricks when dealing with police officers. It's a great interview, and I'm looking forward to sharing the rest of it. So come back next week, and I hope you enjoyed this week. Thanks for listening.